My perception of all of this is that the premier seems to be intimately involved with what's happening, especially with the social studies curriculum development. I submitted a FOIP request back in August, I think, because I wanted to see what Chris Champion's recommendations were. And the FOIP request was denied in full. And one of the reasons was cabinet confidence. I have never seen curriculum go to cabinet before, ever.
Forgotten Corner podcast would not exist without our listeners. If you enjoy the work we are doing on this show and would like to support further, please consider a donation through our Patreon account, patreon.com/forgottencornerpod, or visit our website, forgottencornerpod.com. Welcome back to the Forgotten Corner podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Schmidt, here alongside Jeremy Appel. Jeremy, how are you today, buddy?
I'm not your friend or co-host
anymore. No, we canned that from the show. It's gone.
Since you asked, I am doing all right, hanging in there, rolling with the punches, you know, all that.
Have a list of cliches? You sound like if I'm doing an interview with a hockey player in the second intermission, where it's just like, we just got to get pucks in deep, you know? We're just going to have a big effort, just keep working together as a team.
No, I'm doing well. got a few pieces of journalism coming down the pipeline, so to speak.
Yeah.
Nothing major.
Yeah, I don't have anything exciting to announce either. I suppose we should remind everybody that we're proud members of the Harbinger Media Network. And you should throw out three names of podcasts that people should give a check into.
I would love to. 49th Parahel with Rob Russo. Kino Lefter with Evan McDonald. And Habib T. Please.
Good picks.
Yeah.
Good picks. I wonder if any of those people say our show when they do their show. Probably not, eh?
I don't know. I've never listened to Habib T. Please, but I've heard.
If you don't say the Forgotten Corner on Big Shiny Takes, you're kicked off the show.
I do sometimes.
Yeah, you do. All right. Yeah, we got a pretty good episode this week that we should get into here, because I know everybody's got Saturdays at the Easter Saturdays that they got to get to, but the United Conservatives unveiled their K-6 curriculum this past Monday, Saturday morning here, so March 29th, and you can imagine that it stirred up quite a lot of discussion and debate ever since, and we have one of Alberta's top experts in this field who not shockingly really, was left out of this process. We're going to talk to her a little bit today about why that might be and what kids of the future can expect under this shady curriculum we have. So let's just get right to it. She is an award-winning professor of social studies education at the University of Alberta, holding a PhD in social studies curriculum and pedagogy from the University of British Columbia. So you can probably see where we're going with the episode today. Dr. Carla Peck has been making the media rounds since the United Conservatives unveiled their K-6 curriculum on March 29th. As an Alberta-based expert in social studies and the methods of teaching it, Carla had rightfully been part of the years-long curriculum review started by the Progressive Conservatives and carried on by the NDP. But just like every single one of the hundreds involved in that process, Carla's services were no longer required under the UCP. We are extremely pleased to welcome Carla to the Forgotten Corner this week, where we will not only discuss the final suspect product recently introduced by Education Minister Adriana LaGrange, but also the ins and outs of writing a proper curriculum and how the current provincial government thumbed its nose at the entire process. Carla, welcome to the Forgotten Corner.
Hi, it's great to be here. Great to meet you guys finally.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for taking the time on a Saturday morning to, especially of a week where it seems that every second phone call is a member of the media wanting to get a quote or get an appearance on their show. So it's been a bit of a week for you, I take it.
It's been a pretty busy week. Yep. I didn't realize how exhausting it could be to do all those interviews sort of 12 hours a day, 3 days and in a row sort of thing. But on the other hand, you know, if the public wants to talk curriculum, I'm here for it. You know, it's not something that usually happens in most provinces. It's kind of flies under the radar. So it's great we're having a public debate, but it's got to be an informed debate, right? So that's why I wanted to contribute.
Well, and talk about a debate that's like literally scripted for what you do for a living, right? I mean, like there is no better PhD to have to get involved in a debate than, and like how often does that debate get to come up? So as shitty as this week has been as far as what the future might hold, the spotlight's really on your profession.
Yeah, for sure. It's that doesn't happen too often, that's for sure.
So we want to now on the Forgotten Corner, it's important that we have our listeners get to know our guests. And so as we do on the show, we like to spend the first little bit talking about the guest and where they came from and how they got to where they are. And so this is kind of the time where we sit back and let you talk for a little bit, but you were born in Ontario and raised in Nova Scotia, right? So I'm going to let you kind of go from there and give us the synopsis.
So, yes, born in Ontario, and at around the age 9, my family moved to Nova Scotia, which is where my dad is originally from. And so it was a bit of a homecoming for him, for sure. And yeah, so went to finish off elementary and then went through the rest of the grades in Nova Scotia in a town called Bedford, which is part of the Halifax Regional Municipality area. And you know, had a great time. Love Nova Scotia. It's a great place to grow up. And I have to confess to feeling very landlocked in Alberta because I'm so used to living by an ocean.
It's because we don't have that pipeline to tidewater.
That's it. You read my mind. I was like, oh, there's going to be a connection made there about the landlocked stuff. And so then after high school, went and did a combined honors degree in French and history at Dalhousie University. And as part of that, was able to spend my third year studying French in Aix-en-Provence in France, and finished off my degree. And then I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with my life, and thought about law school, thought about other things. And you know, I had been working to put myself through university. I'd just been working like at a grocery store. And so I sort of was kept doing that because I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and kind of was working my way into management and those sorts of things. And then I had an opportunity to start to coach a summer swim team in a town, a little town called Liverpool. And I was a competitive swimmer as a kid. And so that's why they sort of came to me and said, would you do this? And it was that experience of working day to day with kids that I thought, oh, you know, this is a pretty good gig. I wonder, maybe I should think a little bit more about, you know, being a teacher, which was certainly something that had, you know, been part of my thinking, you know, various points in my life. But so that's when I decided to do my Bachelor of Education, and I moved to Fredericton to pursue that at the University of New Brunswick because I spoke French, and teaching jobs at that time in the 90s were hard to find, you know, because it, like everything, you know, governments sort of contract budgets and, you know, they weren't really hiring a lot of teachers, but I knew if I taught French, I could probably have a good shot at getting a job. So, and New Brunswick being the only officially bilingual province in the country, I thought, well, maybe that's a good place to go do this degree and keep working on my French, you know, that sort of thing. So, I got a degree in teaching French and French immersion and social studies. Sorry, Jeremy, did I cut you off?
Well, you cut me cutting you off, so it's okay. But
you blocked him from cutting you off.
Yeah.
It was a preemptive thing. That's right.
That's right.
I New Brunswick is the only bilingual province. Is
only Quebec. Officially bilingual.
Wasn't Manitoba officially bilingual for... I always thought that I learned that as Manitoba and New Brunswick were like it was a Trivial Pursuit question or some shit.
My understanding is that it's New Brunswick. So it's, I mean, every province certainly has Francophones in it without a doubt. But in terms of government services being required to be offered in French and you know, that sort of thing.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's where that comes
in. While we're on the topic of language here, because you kind of developed a passion for language almost out of, you got to take it for granted and then it just sort of disappeared when you had moved as a kid, right? And that's because I asked you sort of, when we talked earlier, I asked you about how, like, what got you interested in this stuff? So just tell us that story a little bit about how language actually became a passion for you through losing your French teaching.
Yeah, so when I was in Ontario as a kid going to elementary school, as I said, I moved to Nova Scotia. We were actually I was in the middle of grade four. And in Ontario at that time, you didn't actually start taking French until grade six. So when I moved to Nova Scotia and was sort of plunked into a French class, I was like, wait a minute, we're not supposed to be learning French, because my only knowledge was we wouldn't be doing that until, you know, later grades. And for whatever reason, the language clicked. I was able to make sense of it very easily. I was able to learn it very easily. And I mean, that's what ultimately led me to pursuing combined honors in French and history at Dal, and then going to France for the third year of my degree and studying at a French university. And that just absolutely ignited a passion for travel, but also for meeting people, learning about places when I go to visit them. It's one of the reasons I don't really like cruises, because you sort of go and you land on the cruise line, you know, at the cruise port, and everything looks the same no matter what port you go to. And you don't have any chance really to get to know, you know, the place where you are. So I prefer to go and, you know, live in if I can rent a place rather than going to a hotel or something, kind of be, you know, with people and learn about the place. So that's, it was a happy accident, you know, realizing that I could learn French easily, and how that just ended up, when I was nine, ended up being a driving force without even me knowing it as a kid, you know, where I would end up.
Well, it kind of sort of evolved into this, like you talk about having the history double major with the languages, and that kind of evolved into this research on the historical understandings that students have and the relationship that students have with their ethnic identities and things like this. And could just talk about how those two things work together and how this has evolved to now, where you're very passionate about that cultural history and properly taught aspects of democracy and things like this.
Sure. So I don't think we talked about this the other day when we had our call, but when I did my master's degree at the University of New Brunswick, I was very interested in how do students understand ethnic diversity. In my experience as a teacher in New Brunswick, I over time began to realize that the kids that I was teaching, they didn't seem to have, even though New Brunswick is multicultural, there's lots of diversity, kids encounter diversity in lots of places, on TV and movies and, you know, that sort of thing, but also in their real lives. They didn't seem to have a good understanding about difference. They, you know, they didn't understand what it is that, you know, makes somebody unique, or, you know, why somebody might have this particular practice or wear this particular expression, you know, that would be a material expression of their identity. They didn't really understand. So I wanted to dig into that a bit further. And it was absolutely Is fascinating the right word? I mean, it was incredibly illuminating as a teacher to realize, you know, what would need to be done to kind of help students understand different aspects of identity. So I interviewed kids, I gave them these prompts. I took everyday experiences that the kids would be familiar with, like a no hats day in school, for example, which is a very common rule in many schools. I've never understood it. It's like, what's the big deal about wearing a hat in the school? But anyway, it is a fairly common rule. And I asked students, I said, well, what would happen if a person who, because of their, well, I didn't tell them this because I wanted to get them their thinking, but in my head, I was thinking, how would students react if they saw an image of a person who, because of their religious beliefs, wore a head covering of some sort? How would kids interpret that? So I presented them with sort of different images of a kid wearing a yarmulke, a kid wearing a hijab and so on, a turban, and said, you know, these kids think that the no hats rule should be changed in the school. Why do you think that they would want that rule changed? And what I found out with the kids that I interviewed is that almost none of them connected it to religious identity or ethnic identity. They saw a picture of a kid wearing a turban and they're like, well, maybe he's dressed up for like Pirate Day or something, or they just didn't know. And because they didn't know, they didn't, and they weren't being silly or, you know, mean or anything. They just didn't know. And because they didn't know, they had no reason to think about why it might be appropriate to accommodate rights. Of course, in Canada, this is a big aspect of our identity as a society, with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the ability to live and express your faith and your beliefs and so on. And that Canadian society has made accommodations for that over time. So from that research, I then said, okay, for my PhD work, I want to understand, how does ethnic identity shape the way kids think about history? And so I did that work in British Columbia, and similar kind of things, found really strong connections between students' ethnic identities and the way they think about important events in Canada's past. So I paired kids up and I had them do various activities, and then had them talk about what they did. And what emerged out of the research was that kids who had different sort of identity profiles or biographies, whatever you want to call it, they would look at a particular aspect of Canadian history and they would tell a story different from their friend, and that difference emerged because of how they identify. So one kid, for example, who said, well, my dad's from Jamaica and my mom's from, I can't remember now, Germany or somewhere. He says, you know, I'm the epitome of Canadian multiculturalism, right? I'm sort of this blend of two families and this sort of thing. And when he looked at Canadian history, the most important thing for him was multiculturalism, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and that sort of thing. And he had worked with a kid who identified with strongly with sort of British heritage, that he could trace his family back, you know, to England, and they created the same timeline of Canadian history. They had exactly the same events. The kid who had the British heritage, he's like, oh, no. He says the most important event in Canadian history is when people came here from Britain and, you know, made Canada sort of into what it is today. They had written exactly the same story because they had collaborated on it together, but they interpret it differently because of their identity. So yeah, that's how I came to do that, this kind of work.
And so you finished your PhD and you, right away, I believe, right? Like you came to, it was 2000, you came to Alberta 2007, you were offered the job at U of A, correct?
Yeah. In fact, I wasn't even finished my PhD when they offered me the job. So I eventually defended my dissertation in 2009, but I started at U of A in 2007. Yeah.
And so I know we glossed over, cause you had taught elementary school a little bit in New Brunswick, I believe, in between there too. And I want to move forward, but I just wanted to slide that in as well.
Yeah.
Teaching has been part of your life for a very long time.
Absolutely.
When you came here, and moved to Edmonton, if I remember correctly, you were approached pretty quickly about being part of the curriculum review, correct?
That's right. One of the first phone calls I got was somebody from Alberta Education saying, we've got this. Alberta had just started implementing what was then a new social studies curriculum in 2005. And so I came in 2007, and they were doing a staggered implementation to make sure that teachers were well supported in, you know, making this change. And so in 2007, they had a curriculum implementation committee at Alberta Education. And they said, we'd love for you to, you know, be on this committee and help guide us as we do this work. So, gosh, I don't remember who was premier then, but it was definitely a conservative government. And yeah, so I got onto that committee. I started offering professional development sessions to teachers across the province. And it just right from day one when I moved here.
And so I wanted to talk about the process a little bit and just your experiences, because sort of with the direction that you, or the impression you got from the governments that you worked mm-hmm. under and the of the direction they were going, because the PCs, what they started was largely just continued by the NDP, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
So, go ahead. Yep.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so was there any glaring differences between the two governments when the NDP took over to what you guys were already working on? And did they come in sort of with a different, like, did it feel like a different ideology? Or were they continue, you know what I mean? Because certainly, obviously, I'm going to get to the part where the UCP came in with nothing but ideology. I just want to establish whether this is a normal thing for a new government to come in and just sort of scrap the work of the other guys or you know, criticize it anyway.
Right. So under the PCs, the Minister of Education at the time initiated a process called Inspiring Education, where they being Alberta Education, organized all kinds of public engagement sessions to ask Albertans, you know, what do you want for public education in the province, for K-12 education? And they would have sessions like with hundreds of people, and there'd be facilitators, and they'd have these roundtable discussions and brainstorming sessions. So that happened all across the province. And from those inspiring education sessions, then eventually they wrote, you know, a guide for, you know, sort of to give direction to what would happen with curriculum development in the process. Jeff Johnson initiated a new ministerial order on student learning. And again, which is the official document that guides direction for K-12 education. And when the New Democrats came to power, they just used that previous ministerial order. They didn't feel the need. They thought, they looked at it, they evaluated, they go, yep, this looks good to us. They might have done a little bit of tweaking to it, you know, just to kind of update it a little bit, but they did not at all radically change the direction of it, like what this current government has done. So that just shows you that the approach that the New Democrat Party took was to build on what had been done previously and you know, continue in that direction and make it stronger. And of course, they put their own, they brought, you know, their own ideas around, you know, they actually wanted to revise all the curricular area. It was a massive undertaking. I don't know that any province has ever done that before, where they were going to revise every single subject area from K-12 at the same time. Nobody's done that. Usually you see, okay, we're going to do language arts this year or math or this year, or maybe we'll do science and math together, you know, that sort of thing. But to do all subjects in all grades was a massive undertaking. And the reason they did that, one of the reasons anyway, was they said they wanted to have a common architecture across the grades, meaning that if you looked at a curriculum, grade 6 social studies or grade 9 science or language arts, grade 12, whatever, they would be laid out in a similar fashion so that you could easily see these are what the learning outcomes are, these are what the goals are, that sort of thing. Because when curricula are developed separately, they often look very, very different. And so it becomes harder to kind of make connections across the grades. So the idea of having this common architecture was so that teachers could start to make cross-curricular connections, could easily make connections from grade to grade, and just to provide some consistency in the in how these documents were written.
Well, and you, so these groups that did like, were working on these, each of these subjects, because like you said, there were like 50 to 60 people in each of these committees, right?
Yeah.
And then those committees then passed on work to a committee that you were on, correct? That then advised what they were working on. So and your committee had like 50 people on it.
Exactly. So when the NDs came to power, and they decided, okay, we're going to keep the ball rolling with the education curriculum development process. They did something really incredible. And again, I've never seen this in any other province. They convened committees of between 50 and 60 people for every single subject area. So there were 50 or 60 working in science, that many working in social studies, et cetera, et cetera. And 90% of those folks were teachers that were in the classroom. There were a few folks like me, right, from faculties of education. There were some subject matter experts, historians, geographers. I'm just talking about the social studies committee at this point, but the same would apply to the others. There were a couple of ATA representatives because the ATA had signed an agreement with, developed a partnership with the government to ensure that teachers would be involved in the process. And so there were a couple of ATA folks there, but like not, you know, one or two when out of 60. And then of course, some Alberta Education staff to provide, they just sort of led the sessions, right? And they were two groups. There was the curriculum writing groups and then the educator and teacher focus groups. And I was on the second of those. The curriculum writing groups, it's obvious by the title, they were the ones tasked with writing the curriculum. And they met regularly. At one point, I think they were meeting every month. And they would actually, at the beginning of the process, they would talk about, okay, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the current program? What are some things we want to make sure that we, you know, incorporate in the new one? What are our goals for this? But then they also, really importantly, invited people who wanted to make sort of, would you call it pitches, right? They sort of pitch to the curriculum committee, this is what we think should be involved. So, or should be included in the curriculum. And, you know, it might've been a multicultural group or, you know, whatever, saying, we think this is really important. And that's an important part of the process because that's when you really hear from just sort of everyday Albertans, like, this is what matters in our society. This is what we think our kids should learn. Now, they didn't dictate that. They presented it as ideas and it was all considered. And then ultimately the committee made a decision about, you know, what to do with all that information. Once they prepared drafts, the drafts were sent to the committee I was on, the teacher and educator focus group. And it was essentially a validation committee where we would read the drafts. And again, they brought us all together in one room. They broke us into groups. They had us all kinds of, these were all teachers. So we were doing teachery things, right? breaking things apart and brainstorming and all this sort of stuff and providing feedback to the curriculum committee who would then take our feedback and, you know, make modifications or whatnot. So, and that was just an iterative process. It happened over a year and a half, 2 years. And then after the election, we just never heard from Alberta Education again. We had to make a commitment for 5 years of meetings. And so they were all in, you know, I'd put them all in my calendar. And I remember that at one point a meeting was coming up after the election had happened. And I thought, oh, I haven't heard anything about that. I wonder what's happening. So I sent an email to the person who was our contact for this committee. And they wrote back and said, yeah, we're not, those committees, they're not happening anymore. So they were just completely disbanded without any notice, without any, not even a thank you, right? And because it was a lot of time and effort that we put into this. I never got paid, no honorarium, nothing like that. And I was, that's fine. It's actually part of, as a professor, there's three parts to our job. We have our teaching, of course, we have our research, but then part of our job is also service to the community, the professional community, the broader community, whatever you want to call it, and the university committee or community. So my participation in working with Alberta Education was, I consider that part of my service to the profession, right? Yeah. So, you know, to not even get a thank you, it's like, okay, whatever.
But of course, Jason Kenney famously said in 2018 that he was going to put the curriculum through the shredder. So I'm sure it didn't come as a complete surprise to you, but the way they went about it, that seemed to have been a shock to you. Tell me a bit about that. What was that like? All this work you had contributed to just shut disappear. Down.
Yeah, it, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. During the whole election campaign, and in particular, the premier said he was going to put the social studies curriculum through the shredder, right? That was a major target. Math and social studies have been the major targets for this government. And so you're right. It wasn't a huge surprise, but I guess maybe I was naive in thinking, you know, I thought they might at least want to talk to us a little bit to learn about what we had done. Or did we want to be involved? I mean, there are 10 faculties of education in the province, and there are all kinds of experts here, right? People like me, but at other institutions. And they just didn't want to hear from any of us. And none of the teachers that were involved either. I mean, it was just, see you later. Thanks, but no thanks.
It's, I mean, like you said, it's never a shock. It's what I find now is, like, not to fast forward to present day too fast here, but like the way that, like, guys like Matt Wolf have gone about trying to discredit you this week or whatever. And it's just like, what did he go do? Well, she's just an NDP donor, which we should clarify didn't happen until after all of this. Right. So like you were not removed from curriculum review because of any ties to any political party. You and every single other person involved in this process was cut loose, and all of that work was done. Now, I just want to ask one question. Like, I was thinking about it from, you know, that side's point of view or something like that, because without getting into how obviously thrown together and fucking downright plagiarized and garbage this curriculum is, if there's one thing that they could tout, it's that they got this thing done quickly, right? And I just, like, guess I want to ask, like, if the process had evolved, had gone over two particular governments, PCs and NDP, and we're talking about a world that evolves certainly 10 years at a time, no problem. It was the process too long to get something done? Because the way I'm looking at it now, I feel like the curriculum, in order to keep up with actual present day methods of teaching and what's out there, it should be evolving like all the time. I don't know how you can do a 10-year review every 20 years and expect to be updated.
Yeah, it's a really tricky process. So yes, in the previous, let's say the previous two governments, a lot of the times it did feel like sort of start, stop, right? And I can't exactly remember, but my sense is that the NDPs didn't pick up the curriculum torch right away. Like it wasn't in their first year, or maybe not in the first 6 months. And I can't remember exactly the timeline, but it did seem to be taking a long time. On the other hand, at that time, and in much of Alberta's history, it has been the province that has taken the most consultative approach to curriculum development that I have ever seen across the country. So that's a good thing in terms of getting lots of input and really making sure that they're consulting with all kinds of different stakeholders and the general public. So the tricky part about curriculum and you know, if you revise it too often, the reason the when I came here in 2007 that they had this staggered approach to implementation. So they, for social studies, they might have taken like grade one and grade three and grade seven and said, okay, we're going to implement those this year and next year. And then next year we'll add three more grades and so on. The reason is that teachers need a lot of professional development support in order to learn how the new curriculum is different from the previous curriculum. It's not as simple as just reading the document and say, okay, yes, it's the content. That would be easy. If the content is just, here's a page of content and here's a different page of content, then okay, you can read them and you can easily see the difference. But a curriculum also represents a whole philosophy towards teaching. And so the clearest example is to compare what we see with the current draft and the curriculum that's being taught in schools right now. So the curriculum that's being taught in schools right now focuses on developing students' citizenship and identity. Really focus, I mean, the whole raison d'etre for social studies is to help students develop into, they already are citizens, but to develop their sort of citizenship identities as members of Alberta, Canada, you know, the world and so on. And so it's citizenship and identity to help them develop complex thinking skills. And it took an approach that honored the knowledge that students bring into the classroom. Kids are not blank slates. They don't have empty heads. And then we come into the class and, you know, pour knowledge into them. They come with knowledge that it's important to build upon. And then the other major philosophy that guided the curriculum that's currently being taught is that it's important for students to actually actively engage in learning, not passively receive information, but actually engage in historical thinking, analyzing evidence and looking at artifacts and that sort of thing with geography, building maps and, you know, that, you know, learning how it is to see the world through a geographer's lens, that sort of thing. So a lot of inquiry-based learning, which stems from, which I know is a bad word in a lot of circles, but, or at least some circles, not in many education circles, but inquiry learning is based on an idea that students have questions about the world and why wouldn't we, you know, help them dig into those questions and figure out, you know, ways that they can learn about the world that stems from their interests. Of course, it still make connections to curriculum. This draft has none of that at all. There's hardly, it gives lip service to citizenship, but it assumes that just by learning all of this content, that somehow that's going to lead to citizenship development. It assumes that kids don't come in with knowledge that is appropriate for kids to have or that we should actually pay attention to, and instead says, crank that head open and we're going to pour all this information about the Aztecs and Charlemagne and, you know, whoever into your heads because that's what we think you need to know. So that's why implementing a curriculum can be really challenging because the whole sort of philosophy behind a curriculum can be different from one to the next.
Jeremy?
Just to rewind a little. So the UCP gets elected, take a wrecking ball to all the work you did and other educational
experts.
And then they bring in their own people, guys like Chris Champion, who is, I think it's fair to say, is an anti-Indigenous bigot. And so what was your response? Did you expect it to be that bad? What did you make?
Let's break down this panel a little bit, I think, what he's getting to. Like, let's talk about the group they did pick.
It's, so there were a couple of different panels, right? They struck a curriculum advisory panel, which was at the very beginning of this UCP process that was going to, and that's the one that Angus McBeath chaired. And you know, this was going to be the committee.
You know, he's from this, you know, he's from this era when his team is Angus. Oh, sorry, I don't want to go with ageism there.
But. I had totally forgotten about that bizarre press conference he gave last year. The used car salesman.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that panel was struck to provide direction to the Minister of Education about what direction K to 12 education should take. So that bit, and that's where, remember I said the NDP kept the same ministerial order on student learning from Jeff Johnson. This committee basically wrote a new ministerial order that Lagrange then, you know, implemented. So there was that committee. And it really set the direction for what was going to happen with the curriculum, because if you look at their report and then the ministerial order that came out of it in the history, or sorry, the social studies section, it reads like a history curriculum, first of all. And it just talks about, you hear, you read in that document, core knowledge, foundational knowledge, facts, you know, again and again and again. And that just communicates that there is this body of knowledge that sits out there somewhere. Well, let's say it's in the old Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedias that I used to use.
I believe it's on Wikipedia.
That's right.
You're keeping up with this particular curriculum. You can find most of the answers
on Wikipedia. That's right. And so it assumes that there's a body of knowledge, that kids' knowledge actually doesn't matter. Who cares what kind of experiences or knowledge that they come in with, which is a fundamental aspect of good teaching, that we ascertain what the learner knows and then we teach them accordingly. And that goes back to like an ed psychologist named Ocebell in the 1960s. And in other words, that students' prior knowledge and experiences matter and helps us help them make connections to new knowledge. This ministerial order and the report that sort of preceded it just kind of ignores all of that. And then the next committee was when they hired these so-called experts to write the curriculum. And the guy who was hired, as Jeremy said, for social studies is a guy named Chris Champion, who has a PhD in history. To my knowledge, has not had a tenure track position in a university. I think he's had some visiting positions. And in a letter to the editor that I wrote with a couple of historians and another colleague from Faculty of Education back in November, the historians that were participated in the letter, you know, wrote that this person was out of step with contemporary historians, scholarship and thinking. So,
he called it a passing fad, right? Specifically.
Oh, yes. In teaching about residential schools and indigenous history. He uses the word trauma and survivors in quotation marks when talking about residential school survivors, which, by the way, those quotation marks exist in the draft.
Fuck off.
Yeah, they do. If
it's
you
like
just
Dr.
look.
Evil. The laser, you can't see me, but I'm doing
it. Yeah, that's right. So this is a person with a PhD in history, but absolutely no background in K to 12 education or in curriculum and pedagogy. You know, what does it mean to write a good curriculum? So, that's the guy that they hired. So,
but he does have ties to, he's big with charter schools. Is that not, am I wrong here? Isn't that like?
I don't know about the charter schools, but I know he was Jason Kenney's right-hand man when Jason Kenney was Minister of Citizenship and Immigration. He was on his staff. I don't know exactly his position. Although if you look up his bio, Champion's bio, I think he says it somewhere. And so he's got long-standing ties with Jason Kenney. So, I mean, to me, I doubt Adriana Lagrange had ever heard of Chris Champion, but Jason Kenney definitely did. So that, to me, that's another interesting thing about all of this, is that my perception of all of this is that the premier seems to be intimately involved with what's happening, especially with the social studies curriculum development. I submitted a FOIP request back in August, I think, because I wanted to see what Chris Champion's recommendations were. And the FOIP request was denied in full. And one of the reasons was cabinet confidence. I have never seen curriculum go to cabinet before, ever.
Yeah, so there's this projection going on clearly where the UCP, when they're in opposition, say, oh, this curriculum that was actually developed by experts who are nonpartisan is ideological. So we're going to scrap it and create our own that it exists in this void that is free of any ideology. And of course, it is this curriculum that is rigidly ideological. So how do you, as someone who is an advocate for public education, how do you combat that beyond saying, no, you're the one being ideological? You know what I mean? Like, doesn't that make it really difficult? Because there are like layers of bullshit you have to like pull back.
And so many layers, more layers than I ever thought I'd have to deal with. So the first thing is that all curricula is political, right? Anytime you make a decision about what knowledge and whose knowledge matters and is going to be taught to students, you are also making a decision about what and whose knowledge doesn't matter. Right? These are political decisions. And I don't mean political in a partisan sense. I mean political in that they communicate our beliefs about and values, right? We're making value statements about knowledge. So that's the first sort of understanding that's important, is that there's no such thing as a neutral curriculum document, because they always communicate values of the people who have written them. And that's why that wide consultation process that was undertaken by previous governments was so important, so that the Ministry of Education could hear from a wide array of Albertans about what their values are for public education and use that to create the document, instead of saying, these are Chris Champion's values, or these are Jason Kenney's values, and that's what we're going to put in there. Of course, they haven't said that explicitly, but that's what's happening. So I think that's the first step in combating that. The other thing is just to try and, you know, to try and provide evidence, right? That now this government isn't interested in actual facts that would, show that they're wrong. But maybe the clearest example I could give of, you know, facts that fly in the face of statements this government has said about curriculum is, time and time again, Minister Lagrange has said things like, we have to get the left-wing ideology out of curriculum, we have to get this inquiry pedagogy out of curriculum, especially social studies, and she would point to like one question on a quiz that kids were given in one classroom in Alberta and say that this is proof that this curriculum is left-wing ideology. Well, number one, the curriculum that's currently in place was written by a conservative government, number one. Number two, the things that she pointed to were questions of pedagogy, sort of, you know, how to teach, teaching methods. Curriculum and pedagogy are different. Curriculum tells us what to teach. Pedagogy is how to teach. She has no idea about the difference between the two. And yet when you sort of point that out, she's famous for sort of stumbling over her words and not being able to answer. So that's what happens when you point it out, but then they just move on to the next thing.
So since we're talking about the difference between what to teach and how to teach it, you're an expert in both when it comes to social studies. You're an expert in what to teach. You're an expert in the method of teaching it. Which of those do you view as more problematic in this particular curriculum, as in which is worse, what we're actually teaching them, or this fact, the way that we've chosen to teach them, which is this memorize this list of shit and we'll test you on it so you can forget for next year? Or is it even worth deciding which one of these is worse.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because curricula don't give direction to teachers, like teach this way, right? That is supposed to be the purview of the teacher, who is a professional, who is educated on developed expertise in how to best meet the needs of their student, all the different pedagogical approaches you could take. So that's why the current curriculum that is being taught in school said, you know, it's important for students to be able to engage in research and inquiry processes, but they didn't specify do this kind of project or do it this way. They left that to the teachers to decide. With this draft document, well, number one, the content is so developmentally inappropriate, it almost defies belief. The kind of content that is included, whether you look at grade 2 or grade 4 or grade 6, whatever, any of the grades, some of it, I've had people, historians, say to me, my God, I wouldn't teach all of that in one of my university courses, right? So, but the key is, again, getting back to the whole philosophy that underpins the document, is that the philosophy is students only really need a passing reference to these things. They don't actually need to understand. And that comes out of some work out of the US, most notably the Core Knowledge Foundation, and that's the whole philosophy really in a nutshell is passing knowledge is okay. And students need to build up this whole background knowledge before they actually can engage in any kind of critical thinking or really just thinking. I mean, you don't have to actually think that hard to memorize a list. You just have to memorize the list. You don't actually have to think about what the things on that list mean, right? You don't have to develop understanding. Right. And that's the consequence of what's been proposed here, is that it will actually drive instruction. And even though a curriculum shouldn't tell teachers or doesn't usually tell teachers how to teach, teachers are going to feel an enormous amount of pressure to get through, for lack of a better word, all of the content that's included, because it's just so heavy in content. And there's nothing in the curriculum that says students should understand this deeply.
Forget the fact that we shouldn't be increasing the level of core knowledge that we teach these kids at the expense of critical thinking. I'm wondering, would it be safe to say that we should almost be putting less focus on that? Like when I was a kid, there was going to school in the 80s, teaching me the core knowledge was important because I had no other way to learn those particular facts. Does our ability to Google sort of lessen the need to teach just a list of like actual the facts to the kids and spend more time teaching them not only, critical thinking, but also social development?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I would never ever say that knowledge isn't important. Of course, knowledge is important. You can't do thinking without the knowledge. But the idea is, 30, 40 years of social studies research shows us that you got to do those things together, right? So let me give you an example from historical thinking pedagogy, which is one of my major areas of expertise. So when I went to school, history classes often looked like this. The teacher would either stand at the front of the class and would basically tell us things and we had to take notes, or we'd read a textbook. Or in high school, I remember this vividly, and I really loved my teachers. So, you know, I'm not critiquing them, but just sort of this approach maybe. I remember vividly that there would be an overhead projector and overheads with handwriting, right, of notes.
Yeah.
And whoever sat next to the overhead projector had to slide the one overhead up and put the next one on, right? And we just spent the whole class taking notes. That is, you'd call that a banking model of education, where it's like, okay, we need to get this knowledge into your head. We're going to deposit the knowledge into your head, to use that banking metaphor. In a historical thinking pedagogical approach or teaching method approach to teaching history, we have come to understand through research that it's important for students to not only engage with that historical content, but to do so in a way where they start to learn the practices of the historian. So they don't just read a textbook entry, but they actually learn how to ask questions about that textbook entry to sort of validate it, corroborate it with other sources, ask questions about, you know, is this sort of the full story of what's going on? Are there other perspectives, that sort of thing? We would give students primary sources like photographs and diary entries and, you know, whatever we're doing, to have them interpret those sources to try and understand what was happening in the past. So the key difference in the two approaches is, when I went to high school or even elementary school, it was, we're just going to just take this information and somehow get it in your head. In this approach that's grounded in 30 or 40 years of research is, okay, we want you to learn this knowledge. Of course, historical knowledge is important, but we want you to actually work with and learn and develop that knowledge by using the skills of the historian, the practice of the historian. And then the same would be true for thinking, you know, geographically, thinking through an economist lens, that sort of thing. So yeah, this approach that is reflected in the draft curriculum doesn't reflect any of the current research. Well, not just current, long-standing research in social studies education.
To what end do you think the government made these radical changes to the updated curriculum? Like, what purpose does it serve in your view politically?
Well, I can't get into Jason Kenney's head, and I probably don't ever want to, but what this social studies draft curriculum represents is an idea about what makes somebody a good citizen. And I said a while ago that that's really the ultimate goal of social studies education, right? Is citizenship education. And there's sort of four aspects of citizenship education that we think about. One is intellectual development. If you think of it as a continuum, a matrix. So there's a horizontal and a vertical axis. On the horizontal axis, we have, on the vertical axis, I guess it doesn't matter. We have intellectual development on one end and personal development on the other. And then on the horizontal axis, we have social conservation on one hand, on one side, and social transformation on the other. And usually teachers are somewhere in the matrix, right? They're not just on one end. But this curriculum represents purely the social conservation approach to citizenship that says, here is the body of knowledge that we think is important. It's a very specific Western, Christian, white knowledge with a few, few other, and they are definitely made other in this curriculum, groups, you know, sprinkled in for optics. But this is, we want to just keep society the way it is. This is the society that we think is a good one. And so we're going to replicate it by teaching this to students. So keeping society exactly the way it is. And Jason Kenney has recently said, well, I learned about Genghis Khan when I was in grade two. Right. So that, you know, that's good for kids to do. And it's like, okay, so when you were in grade two, I'm guessing he's about the same age as me. So that's 40 some years ago. So that's your basis for saying that that's how we're going to develop curriculum, by going back in time. I mean, it's just ridiculous, but it conveys a certain idea about what society should look like and what citizens should be like. And he wants kids just like him.
Am I being a bit conspiratorial when I suggest that the reason that they brought forward this curriculum draft, which was, you know, parts of it were plagiarized from Wikipedia, there are parts that are clearly copy and pasted from US curriculums because they don't change anything, it's all American examples, that the goal of this is to blur the distinction between public and private educations and drive people out of the public system.
Well, there is certainly a concern there. And it's layered on top of other legislation and initiatives, right? Opening up charter schools to be able to offer more charter schools, you know, the kind of funding that is provided to different kinds of schools in the province. And I mean, this is not just an Alberta phenomenon, but it's happened around the world where public systems get decimated one way or the other. You remove funding, you fire 20,000 educational assistants, like was done here, under the cover of, you know, pandemic, when actually kids needed more support, not less, because they were transitioning to a whole new learning environment. And yeah, I mean, it has that effect of, so you weaken the public system, and then you point to the public system and say, oh, look, it doesn't work. And then, and you use that as the rationale to, you know, get the private system, you know, more robust and more popular. But it, you know, it's this recurring cycle of weaken it, say it doesn't work, and say, oh, here's a good alternative. And we've seen this for around the world in different places, not just here.
Yeah, and in many different disciplines, not just education.
For sure. That's right. Not just education. Right?
As you said, you take a wrecking ball to the public sector, and then you say, wow, the public sector is really not working.
Yeah.
I guess we'll have to privatize. And then the private system doesn't work either, or it works even worse, but they're like, public system wasn't working either. What are you going to do?
That's right. No. So, I mean, there's concern with that in healthcare, right? Big time, obviously. 100%.
Now, we have to wrap up, but I have one more question. And I always say I'm not going to put people on the spot, but I might be kind of a little bit here, so I apologize. But I find it important whenever we do stuff like this that we have to understand that, like, we don't want to give the I don't want to always give the impression that everyone thinks how we are thinking or whatever. And sometimes there are people saying the exact opposite of what we're saying. And Leisha Corbella, our illustrious Calgary Herald UCP donating columnist, wrote saying that educational experts give this curriculum an A+. She included one educational expert who just happens to work in education. I don't know if that makes you an educational expert, and be it, the reason why I say I'm putting you on the spot is because it happens to be what I would consider a colleague at the U of A, George Georgiou, is a psychology professor who says things like, these are implementing the best teaching, proven teaching methods out there. And I was wondering if you could just speak maybe you don't want to get into him specifically, but are we wrong? Or are they just able to find people that are willing to wave whatever flag they want, if that makes sense.
Yes. So Dr. George Georgiou is a colleague and a friend and is absolutely a world expert in reading, right? In helping kids learn how to read and figure out, you know, if there's a learning difficulty, then how can we help them? Or even if there's not a learning difficulty. So without question, his expertise is top notch. But that's the only curriculum he was commenting on, was the language and literacy curriculum. He wasn't commenting on social studies or math or science or anything like that. So I read that column and I had the same impression as you. It's like, okay, one person, right? But if you notice in that column, Corbella doesn't talk at all about the social studies curriculum. She's not actually pointing to any experts when it comes to social studies curriculum. So I think when people read columns like that and other commentary, they have to be really mindful about, okay, what area does this person have expertise in and what part of the curriculum are they talking about? And unfortunately, this government has a really bad habit of using one little soundbite to apply it to an entire, you know, in this case, curriculum in all subject areas. So, I mean, when they trotted out Jordan Peterson yesterday,
I was about to ask about that.
That he approves or thinks this is a great Alberta-led initiative. Well, right away, that phrase Alberta-led initiative tells you he doesn't know anything about curriculum development, because curriculum is and education is the purview of provinces. It's not a national, right, constitutionally. So, of course, it's going to be an Alberta-led initiative, duh, right? Except for actually, we might argue it's a U.S. base because they've drawn so much from the U.S. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. But I will also say this, that I have had social studies and history colleagues, professors and teachers from across the country and internationally. A friend wrote from Mexico just yesterday. She said, my God, Alberta's curriculum has always been so high regarded internationally. There are international schools that use it. She said, what is happening in Alberta? And that's the message I've been getting all week from colleagues all over Canada and all over the world. And I even had a teacher from BC write to me yesterday and said, can I come and help you guys fix this? Like, this is wrong. You know? So, I mean, we're just a laughing stock. And yet at the same time, people are really concerned, you know, about what this is going to mean for kids' education.
We like to be laughing stocks in about just about every category. We want to be internationally known for being idiots every step of the way. Last thing I'll say is I did read today that Edmonton Public Schools and I believe another division, and I now believe Calgary is thinking about it, are refusing to be part of the pilot project of this curriculum. At least the EPS is for sure.
Or St. Delaware. About six now that have said that they're not going to pilot it. And they're quite large school districts.
EPS has got to be the second biggest.
I would think so. After Calgary, I think, is the biggest. I haven't heard anything from Calgary yet. I remain ever hopeful. And
what a statement that would make.
It would. And of course, the minister, when asked about this, said, oh, well, they just won't be able to provide, you know, feedback based on in-classroom experience. But I don't know how the government with any kind of legitimate authority could implement a curriculum that a major percentage of the province hadn't actually been involved in validating. I don't know how you do it without just continuing to be a laughingstock.
Well, I mean, you don't. I don't think they care. That's part of this. No. Like, I really don't. They mustn't, because at first I thought, you know, well, maybe they didn't realize some of these methods of how they do things, whether it be the war room or our education curriculum. Maybe they didn't realize that those were going to backfire, but they double down on everything.
They're just so dogmatic, right? They're just, yeah. And unfortunately, school boards have the option to not pilot, but they don't have the option
to not implement.
Exactly.
Well, and this is the thing, but they will, you know, if EPS and hopefully Calgary Public as well join and say, like, we're not going to pilot this. Mm-hmm. If you implement that curriculum in the face of that, I mean, that's going to be a major, major election issue for them. Yeah, and I don't think they expected that. Nonetheless, we're at our time here. I know Mo has some stuff he's got to get to today, so we'll get him off the hook here. But Carla, thank you so much for coming on the show. I wanted this interview to be exactly like it was, not specifically going through point by point of the curriculum, which I think anyone can do. And I think we've seen tons of. I wanted to talk today about the process and the fact that there's a proper process and why it wasn't taken. And it was very clearly deliberately avoided. And that's what people need to understand, that, like, if you have these problematic ideological ways of doing anything, of course the end result is going to be problematic and ideological. And of course it's going to be, we're going to look at it and be baffled every step of the way and baffled at just the laziness behind it, because they're trying to get one thing together. So before I let you go, I want to give you the last word.
Well, I just want to say that how glad I am that this is part of the public conversation in Alberta. That doesn't always happen. We've seen so-called history wars in places like Australia and in Quebec too, where there are big debates about what history and how history should be taught. But usually curriculum just flies under the radar and people just accept it and, you know, okay, send their kids and to school and that's it. But these are very high stakes because the curriculum that's implemented, curricula don't change that often and that quickly, as we already talked about. And this curricula is going to affect a whole, you know, years and years of kids. And therefore it's going to affect, I mean, ask ourselves, is this curriculum going to produce the citizens that we need to solve the problems of tomorrow? And it's not.
100%. Jeremy, take us out, buddy.
I think that's a great point to end on. Thank you so much for joining us, Carla. Now is the part of the show where we like to thank our patrons who go above and beyond for us. I'm talking specifically about Nancy Niles, Chris Sterwald, Big Red Machine, Dave Bonmiller. Thank you so much, and keep on listening.
To the rest of our patrons, thank you guys. Hit some 5-star reviews if you can. Share this episode. Keep talking about curriculum. There's a fucking ton to worry about right now. 2021's just as big a shit show as 2020 was. It ain't getting better, but you got to stay the course. You got to stay focused. Keep doing what we're doing. We'll see you guys next week. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye.